Thank you, Brother Bob, and good morning. How's everyone doing this morning? Awesome, excellent. Quick question for you guys. How many of you can read? I'm still seeing one or two hands not up. Okay, well, that's awesome, because I'm going to ask you guys to read some verses occasionally through the class. You all right with that? Excellent. Now that I know you all can read, that's fantastic. Well, I'm excited about this series of classes that we're going to actually start with the life of Jonathan. And the reason we're going to start with Jonathan is because this was a major influence in the life of David. We're going to see as David develops, as David goes through trials, as David comes to the throne, even after Jonathan's gone, the influence that Jonathan had had on David, who was a much older man than he was, probably double his age, and yet a great kinship and friendship had developed between these two individuals. So I said that our title is about developing spiritual intelligence. Does anybody know when the IQ test... Do you guys know what the IQ test is? Everybody familiar with the IQ test? Yeah? Okay. It's called intelligence quotient. It's a measurement of a person's ability to grasp information. That was established in 1905. And it was felt that if you could identify people with a certain amount of intelligence, that we could then put those type of people in different types of jobs. And since 1905, the world's been fascinated with intellect, with intelligence, while we're standing in a university, which is all about nurturing and developing and growing knowledge based on having intelligence. More recently, there's also been a suggestion that it's not just intelligence that's important, but emotional intelligence. Have you guys heard anything about that? EQ versus IQ, emotional intelligence. And what they've done is they've looked and they said, well, actually, people that are the most successful people in organizations have a high emotional intelligence. They're able to sense how they ought to respond to certain situations, and they use that for their advantage. Well, today, and this week, God willing, our focus is going to be developing spiritual intelligence. Because although our Heavenly Father's given us the intelligence to understand the truth, His Word, and although He's given us the ability to reflect His character, to have an emotional response to each other, what God really cares about is the development of spiritual intelligence in our lives. And we're going to look through the qualities, having spent some time with Jonathan. We're going to spend a little bit of time with Saul and learn what we ought not to do, and then look at the life, the majority of our time, look at the life of David. Today's quality we're going to consider is the quality of leadership and the ability to inspire others. That's what we're going to see in the individual that we're going to look at today, is he had an incredible ability to inspire others. In this class, we're going to see that he inspires somebody to do something that is absolutely insane. And I know that young men often will do things that I might consider insane now that I'm in my early 50s. But when I was a teenager, I was doing as well. I thought it was really cool to ride as fast as I could and hit the front brakes so that I could make $20. You know, they're insane now. But when I was young, those things I did. But this was a man in his 40s or late 30s. We're going to see that some of the things that he's able to inspire other people to do would be considered by most of us to be insane. And yet he did it because he was a leader and because he had faith. As we look into the lives of first Jonathan and then David, we're going to see exhibited in them the character of saints. We're going to see men of courage, men of faith. We're going to see individuals that trusted not in their own strength, but in Yahweh of armies. We're going to see men valiant in battle and also in spirit. They're men of leadership who exercise spiritual discernment. They're also passionate men who know how to love. And we hope, young people, by the way, how many are here in the class are baptized? Okay, so we've got a handful, so I'll say brothers and sisters and young people. I do hope, young people and brothers and sisters, that we grow a new appreciation for Jonathan that we may not have had before when we see in his character qualities that David came to admire. We'll consider that the basis behind David's own spiritual success was the influence of this individual, and then see how we can try to apply the lessons from Jonathan's life in our own. Our classes today are going to be taken from 1 Samuel 13 and 14. And you know what's absolutely brilliant? What was our Bible reading yesterday? 1 Samuel chapter 14. So our daily Bible readings this week will actually help us as we progress through our classes. Now, 13 was 2 days ago on Friday. So we're going to begin then looking in 1 Samuel chapter 13 at this individual named Jonathan. Anybody know what Jonathan's name meant? Yes. Yahweh is given, that's right. John or Yah hath given. And indeed he had given. He had given Jonathan to the nation of Israel to inspire them, because the leader that they had was not inspiring whatsoever, as we're going to see. He gave Jonathan to Saul, even though Saul was head and shoulders above everyone else. We're introduced to him the second time as someone who hides behind the stuff. And he was given to David. And in David, he was given a better friend than one could ever ask for. All right, let's read together from 1 Samuel 13, verses 1 to 4. And I need our first volunteer then to read 1 Samuel 13, verses 1 to 4. My only request when you volunteer is that you read nice and loudly. Yes, go ahead. Excellent, thank you, and thanks for reading nice and loudly. Well, this is the first time the scriptures tell us about Jonathan. Now, as we read through here, what can we ascertain about this individual? He's obviously the captain, a captain of the army, because Saul the king has 2,000 men with him, 3,000 men with him, sorry, 2,000 men with him, and Jonathan has 1,000 with him, and the rest of them are all home in their tents. So there's the Philistines, and only 3,000 soldiers have been called out by Saul. Two are with him and one with Jonathan. And that's all we know about Jonathan from these verses, isn't it? We're not told that he's a prince. Are we told how tall Jonathan is? Nope. We were told that of Saul being head and shoulders above everyone else. We're not told of his lineage. We're not told of his royal position. We're only told of one thing, his action. And what was that action? Well, he took the 1,000 men, the smaller army that he had, and he went and smote a garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. That's what we learn about Jonathan in the first occurrence of the mention of his name. But did you notice something else in verse 4? What did all Israel hear after Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines? What says it, verse 4, and all Israel heard say that, who? Saul. Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines. Saul was still there with his 2,000 men. And yet, all Israel hears say that Saul has smitten the garrison of the Philistines. Now, how does Jonathan react in verse 4? Is he raged? Does he go and challenge his father, why on earth did you do that? Does he try to let everyone else know in the land, actually it wasn't Saul, it was me and my garrison, and I only had 1,000 people. Saul, he had 2,000, and he was just sitting over there doing nothing. And I took my 1,000 and I went and smote them. Let me tell you about the battle. Is that there in verse 4? No. So we've actually learned already about the first character of leadership. What Jonathan does is more important than who he is. What he does is more important than who he is. And this, we're going to come to see, is a guiding principle in this man's life. Perhaps it was such because it was so opposite with his father, who took credit for what he didn't do. Jonathan cared not about the credit. Do you know President Ronald Reagan, just before all of your times, had a sign on his desk in the Oval Office, which read, "You can get the most done when you don't care who gets the credit." It's contrary to one of the three impulses of the flesh, isn't it? It's contrary to the pride of life. And it was contrary to how his father acted. For him, who he was more important than, well, even the truth, not just what he had done. So there's our first character of leadership, and the first thing we learn about Jonathan. What he does is more important than who he is. Well, then we see that Jonathan's character and Jonathan's faith with which he had gone and smitten this garrison, this unit of the Philistines, is contrasted to Israel. In verse 4, does it talk about the nation of Israel jumping up and down and rejoicing that someone has gone and fought against these Philistines, which have been oppressing them and making their life challenging? No. No, there's no rejoicing. In fact, what does it say? It says that Israel heard that they were held in abomination with the Philistines. This had happened once before when the Philistines ruled over Israel. And a man went down and he burned their fields. Do you remember that occasion? Tied some foxes together and put a firebrand between them, and they ran all over and they burned the fields of the Philistines. And instead of Israel rejoicing that those who were oppressing them had been conquered, or at least the start was there, and rallying behind Samson, who did those events, no, it was the same spirit that had existed in the time of the judges. Instead, they're like, oh man, now they're going to make life harder for us. We remember what happened back in Egypt. You know, when that guy Moses came along, and he made life harder for the children of Israel in Egypt. Well, yeah, but remember the other part where he freed them from Egypt and brought you into the land that you're in today. But they didn't remember. They were just worried about what was immediately in front of them. And what was immediately in front of them was life was going to get a little bit more difficult if they challenged the status quo. Well, now that's interesting, isn't it? Can that apply to us, that principle apply to us? Is life easier if we just go with the flow? That which we're taught in high school now and university now. How many in high school in here? University? There's a few in university and most in high school. 5 in university. So it doesn't matter whether you're in high school, whether you're in university. Same foundations being taught there. We considered it briefly on the other side of the wall with the adults. It's the teaching of the beast. It's the teaching of the serpent. It's the teaching of Babylon. It's the cup of wine as it's described, which all nations have been made to drink. And it's so much easier just to go with the flow, to not say anything, to not rock the boat. Well, that's how the children of Israel were. And they were really concerned now because here was this man, Jonathan, and he'd rocked the boat. He had challenged what was being taught, as it were, when you compare it to our lives. He was speaking out against tolerance. He was speaking out against immoral behavior. He was speaking out against the teaching of this world, which says that the teachings of God are shameful and we should be embarrassed of. Here's a man who stood up like any of us can, who had courage and faith in his God, and he rocked the boat. And Israel wasn't happy about it. And neither was the Philistines. So were the Philistines. So what do they do in verse 5? Well, they gather themselves together. They amass an army. They have 30,000 chariots. That would be like drones in today. I mean, they were on the ground, so maybe tanks. But, you know, in terms of advanced technology, be like having 30,000 military drones in today's language. And they had 6,000 horsemen. So that would be like the tanks on the ground, or maybe converse, whichever. A massive army with technology that far exceeded Israel. In fact, we're going to find out at the end of this chapter that the Philistines had taken away all the weapons in Israel. So here's this massive army now that's amassed in Israel with all this advanced warfare technology, and the children of Israel, well, they freak out. Can someone read for us verses 6 and 7 of 1 Samuel 13? Another volunteer. Yes, please. Amazing. There's the faith of Israel. Jonathan says to his 1,000 soldiers, "Hey guys, I got an idea. Why don't we go beat up some Philistines today?" And off they go. That sounds great. The 1,000 men that followed Jonathan, they weren't afraid of rocking the boat. But the rest of Israel, what do they do, as just was read for us? Well, they hid themselves. Caves and bushes, under rocks, up in high places on mountains, down in pits and wells. That was the faith of the nation at this time. And that's some of them. Some of them fled across the Jordan River to Gad and Gilead, to the other side, because the Philistines, remember, were on the Mediterranean Sea. They were along the coast there. They actually have found archaeological evidence that they were boat people that had come off from maybe one of the isles or islands in the Mediterranean, and they had settled there after trying to settle in Egypt. And the Egyptians had said to the Philistines, "We don't want you here." And they tried to settle up in Syria. And they said in Syria, "We don't want you here." And they ended up settling in the coasts of Canaan because they came in and they conquered the people that are there. Do you know, it's interesting that there's a people who live in the land today, in the same territory, who've had the same experience. The Palestinians tried to live down in Egypt with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians said, "No, thank you. We don't want you living here because you're a tumultuous people." So they went up to Lebanon, and they tried to live with the Lebanese, and the Lebanese said, and this is in, you know, before your day, this is in my day, well, a little before my day too, actually. They tried to go up to Lebanon and live there, and the Lebanese said, "No, thank you. We don't want you living here." And then they crossed over the Jordan River, and the Jordanians took them. And do you know what they did there? Well, they started a war against Jordan, who had been the only nation that was willing to take them in of all the neighboring nations. The same spirit and the same culture exists today that existed back in this day with these Philistines. So there they are, coming from the coast into Israel. And there's many of the Israelites, those that haven't found a place to hide. Well, they keep running across the river, over the Jordan, into Gad and Gilead, which were territories that had been settled by Ephraim and Manasseh. And then others went to Paul at Gilgal, up to the north. They'd gone up there. Or sorry, that was to the east as well, to Jordan. But this side of Jordan. And they trembled after Saul. What a leader he was. We'll find out, actually, that there's another category of people in this chapter as well. So there's four things that they do. And we'll save that a few minutes. Well, back in 1 Samuel chapter 10, Samuel had commanded that when these circumstances arose, that they should wait for Samuel for 7 days, and that he would come and he would offer an evening sacrifice. And so we read down at verse 8, you know, and by the way, that for cross-reference is in 1 Samuel 10, verses 5 to 8 in my Bible. Beside verse 8, he tarried know if you guys have this, but I have a cross-reference in my Bible, and if you don't, if you've got a pencil, you might want to put that in there. Why did Paul tarry 7 days according to the set time that Samuel had appointed? Because back in 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse 8, Samuel had said, hey, when you're king, and when the Philistines come and assemble against you, then I want you to wait 7 days, and then I'll come and offer a sacrifice. And so at verse 8, he tarries 7 days according to the set time. But when Paul sees that the people, Saul rather, sees that the people are scattered, he says, well, bring me the burnt offering and I'll do it. And verse 10, he offers the burnt offering himself. Forget this Samuel guy. I don't know what's happened to him, but everybody's running away. I need to consolidate my power. We need to move on. We need to do something here. So he offers the sacrifice. And then Samuel arrives. Samuel says to him in verse 11, what have you done? He says, well, I saw the people were scattered. I saw you didn't come. I saw that the Philistines had gathered themselves together. The three reasons. Did any of them have to do with Saul being impatient? Did any of them have to do with Saul at all? No, not at all. It was everyone else that was the reason that Saul offered the sacrifice. And not only that, but he made himself do it. It says in verse 12, then said I, the Philistines will come down upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplications unto the Lord. So I forced myself, therefore, and offered a burnt sacrifice. And verse 13 and 14, I want us to pay special attention as we read through this. Samuel, in condemning Saul's actions, is going to declare a punishment to Saul. But as we read through, pay attention to who the punishment is actually going to be inflicted upon. All right, I need another volunteer to read for us verses 13 and 14 of 1 Samuel 13. Yes, back row there. First Samuel 13, verses 13 and 14. Nice and loud, please. All right. So Saul's done foolishly. Samuel pronounces an edict. The Lord would have established thy kingdom forever. I want to pause there on that because that tells us something about our God. God would have established Saul's kingdom forever. So see, God doesn't set people up for failure. Who had asked for a king? Did God suggest they have a king? No. The people had asked for a king to be like the other nations. And did God choose a king that he would have chosen to be their king? No, he chose a king like they wanted a king. Someone that was tall, someone that was muscular. That's what they chose, that's what they wanted, that's what he gave them. But he doesn't set them up for failure, even though this was the desire of the people and not his will. He still would have established Saul's kingdom forever. Now, it doesn't say thy kingship. It says thy kingdom. And what are we told then in verse 14? Now thy kingdom shall not continue, for the Lord has sought a man after his own heart and commanded him to be captain of the people, because thou hast not kept which the Lord commanded thee. See, this didn't actually affect Saul. He would still be king, but his kingdom would not continue. So who was impacted by the impulsive actions of Saul? Jonathan. His son, the one that would have come to the throne. And what's incredible is that Jonathan was actually a man after God's own heart as well, as we're going to see as the record unfolds. But because of the actions of Saul, Jonathan will not come to the throne. God will replace him. And just to emphasize that, the scripture for the first time at verse 16 says, "And Saul and Jonathan his son." Why tell us he's his son now? Because now we can understand the significance of the pronouncement that Samuel has just made. Jonathan, this good man, this good leader who's led 1,000 men to go fight against a garrison of the Philistines, has been rejected to coming to the throne. How does Saul respond? He really doesn't. How does Jonathan respond? Well, he really doesn't. This is the context, then, as we turn over our page to 1 Samuel chapter 14 and our Bible readings last night. Think about this context. Jonathan has just learned that because of the impulsive nature and lack of faith of his father, he will no longer come to the throne. See, from the time that Saul came to the throne, he would have been grooming his son to be the next king in Israel. He was a prince wearing princely clothing. We'll see that when we come to 17, after David kills Goliath, and we'll see Jonathan strip himself of his royal apparel and give it to David. Because what Jonathan does is more important than any title, than any genealogy, than any family name that he might have. There's no pride associated with being a Smith, or in this case, a Saul of Benjamin, a Saul of Kish. There's no pride associated with his family name, because what he does is more important than who he is. And does this change his behavior? Does Jonathan now say, "Oh man, I mean, all this stuff I was doing to be getting ready to be a king, I was going to be a better king than my father. Now I don't have a choice of coming to the kingship because of what my father has done." Does he reprimand his father? Does he walk out of the court in anger? No. He now has an armor bearer. See, his father's learned a lesson. If you give Jonathan 1,000 people, he'll go start a war. So I'm not going to give Jonathan 1,000 people anymore. We come to 1 Samuel 14, and we see it's just Jonathan and his armor bearer. But before we get there, remember the children of Israel are in the land. And we commented that they were in the land long enough to have confiscated all of the weapons of the children of Israel. I'm going to read for you verses 16 to 22 in a modern translation. 1 Samuel 13, verses 16 to 22. "The Philistine army was camped at Michmash. Each day they sent out patrols to attack and rob villages and then destroy them and burn them. One patrol would go north along the road to Ophrah in the region of Sheol. Another patrol would go west along the road," I guess it's backwards, "it would go west along the road to Beth Horon. A third patrol would go east toward the desert on the road to the ridge that overlooks the Zeboim Valley. The Philistines would not allow any Israelites to learn how to make iron tools. If we allow that," they said, "those worthless Israelites will make swords and spears." Notice the great disdain they had for God's people, which was actually shared by many of the neighbors of Israel. And then it says, "Whenever the Israelites wanted to get an iron point put on a cattle prod, they had to go to the Philistines." So they'd even taken away the ability to make sharp instruments. They would go to the Philistines. "Even if they wanted to sharpen plow blades, picks, axes, sickles, and pitchforks, they had to go to the Philistines, and the Philistines would charge high prices." How humiliating for Israel. "So whenever the Israelite soldiers had to go into battle, none of them had a sword except for Saul and Jonathan." Now that's a really important point that we're going to hold on to for a later class. There's only two swords and two spears in all of Israel. Saul has one, and Jonathan has one. How long had they been there, the Philistines? Well, they were there long enough to send patrols out to pillage and burn villages. They were there long enough to kill all the blacksmiths. They were there long enough to confiscate weapons. They had them in the battle against the Ammonites previously. Now they post a garrison at the passage of Michmash. And their enemies, the children of Israel, have no weapons. And we find out there's only 600 men left with Saul. Where are the rest? Well, some are hiding in wells. Some are hiding in caves. Some have fled across the Jordan River to Gad and Gilead. And some, just 600, are now trembling with Saul. So let's go to chapter 14. And let's read verses 1 to 3, where we have this context. Could I get another volunteer to read 1 Samuel 14, verses 1 to 3? Yes, go ahead. Nice and loud. So here's Jonathan. He's sick and tired of waiting. There's his father as far away from the battle as possible. He's in the outskirts, the uttermost part of Gibeah, under a pomegranate tree. That's interesting that it describes him as being under a pomegranate tree. Do you know that the pomegranate, the fruit of a pomegranate, has inside white fleshy seeds? Anybody eaten a pomegranate before? Yeah, some of you have. White fleshy seeds, but the inside of the pomegranate, which is red and purple, has a dye in it, and the red dye sort of permeates, so they actually come out as red seeds. So they're white seeds that have been made red because of the fruit. And they are a symbol of spiritual Israel, white being a symbol of righteousness, and red, the blood of Christ, that through the blood of Christ we're made righteous. So there's the symbol of spiritual Israel. And how spiritual was Israel at this time? Well, as far as we can tell, outside of Samuel, there's one individual, Jonathan, and those people that Jonathan was able to influence. And there's Saul with his trembling 600 people. And he'll be overshadowed that day by one who is represented by the pomegranate. You see what was wrong with the situation here? Who was in control of the circumstances at the beginning of 1 Samuel chapter 14? Was it Saul, the king? It's the Philistines, isn't it? The Philistines are in total control of what's going on in the land. Killed the blacksmiths, took away all the sharpening tools, taken away all the weapons, burning and pillaging villages, and everybody's hiding or trembling with Saul. Everybody's shaking. And Jonathan's there waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for his dad, the king, to take action. And so when his dad doesn't take action, he slips away unnoticed. He told not his father. He takes an armor bearer with him, holding his spear. Jonathan, no doubt, still with his sword, a spear and a shield. Now there's two. Before it was 1,001, Jonathan and 1,000 against a garrison of the Philistines. Now there's two individuals. And before them is an army that have the latest warfare, an innumerable host, the latest technology, and all of Israel, the 600 soldiers that are still with Saul, have axes and pitchforks and cattle prods with them and hoes for tilling the field. Those are the odds between the children of Israel and the Philistines. All right, let's read together verses 4 and 5, which are two whole verses dedicated to describing the landscape. Another person to read verses 4 and 5. Yes.
Thank you.
So we're describing then for two whole verses these rocks that they're standing on. Now what it's actually describing is that there's a cliff, a sharp rock, this rocky crag, as you read in the King James, it says a sharp rock, a steep cliff. And on the one side of the steep cliff called Sina is Jonathan and his armor bearer. And then there's a valley. And then there's another steep cliff. And on top of the other steep cliff is 20 Philistine soldiers, we're going to see. There's 20 men that are standing on this little cliff's edge that sort of juts out. And two verses are given to describing what this looks like and also giving us the name of these two places. So clearly the scripture is telling us to look into these things. Well, the word Bozez means surpassing white, glistening. We already said that white represents the righteousness of the saints. And that was on the north side against Michmash, where the Philistines were. So there was a rock, a cliff, that was white and glistening, and it represented the righteousness of the saints. And the side they're standing on is called Sina. And that word Sina is the word thorny. It's used in Exodus 3 to describe the burning bush. And what was the burning bush all about? Well, it was where God revealed that his presence would be with Moses and with the children of Israel. And so what was the message that God was telling Jonathan and his armor bearer as they stood there? God's presence is with the righteous. And this is what Jonathan believed. The message of the names of the rocks is just expounding for us what Jonathan believed. God is with us and not with them. And this is a powerful perspective. Brothers and sisters and young people, it's a powerful perspective to take with us into school, into work, into our communities, wherever we go. God is with us if we're trying to uphold his principles in our life. God is with us if we have faith. Faith in what? His ability to forgive our sins, and faith in his ability to fulfill his promises of the kingdom. And if that describes us, then God is with us and he's not with them. See, that perspective is one we need to take into school. If we're being isolated in high school or university or at our work because we're different, because we're trying to uphold the principles of God, it's okay. Because God is with us and not with them. He will work in your life to help you overcome whatever trial you're going through because you're trying to reflect his character. And what does Jonathan say then? Having been reminded through the names of these rocks that God's with us and not with them, Jonathan says at verse 6 to the young man that bears armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised." He has a clear picture of who these people are. They are not the people of the covenant. They are not God's people. "Let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or by few." Did Jonathan presume that God would help them? No, he says to his armor bearer, "It may be that God will be with us." Remember the description of where they're standing. The Philistines are just over there, as it were, at the back door. But between the Philistines and where Jonathan and his armor bearer, two people, are standing, there's a cliff. And when Jonathan says, "Let us go over to them," that means, okay, we're going to scale down this cliff wall, and then we're going to go across the valley where they could shoot with their bows and arrows down at us, and then we're going to climb a cliff back up to where the Philistines are over there. And what does the armor bearer say? Okay. That's what he says in verse 7. "Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee. Behold, I am with thee according to thy heart." Here was a man who inspired greatness. Here was a man who would motivate people to do something that they themselves would never have considered or thought was impossible. Are you actually saying, Jonathan, that you want us to scale down a cliff, cross over that valley where they could shoot us, and then climb back up a cliff on the other side, and then we'll be good and ready to fight against the Philistines for sure, because we've just scaled down a cliff and back up a cliff? The armor bearer says, whatever's in your heart, I'm willing to follow. The quality of a leader, somebody who's more concerned about what he does than who he is, that person can inspire greatness in other people. He recognizes that God is not bound to helping them, but he may. That God is able to save by many or by few. Where had he learned that? Had he learned it from his father, trembling in the uttermost part of Gibeah with 600 men who were trembling after him? No, he'd probably learned it from the battle of Gideon, who went out with an army of 32,000, and God said, no, that's too many people. Okay, we've reduced it to 10,000 now. God says, no, that's too many people. 300 men. God is able to save with few. Jonathan knew his Sunday school lessons. He knew about Gideon. And there's Jonathan who decides he's going to take on an army of 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, an innumerable host, and says to his one man with him, let's go do it. And he says, whatever's in your heart. But see, he'd reminded him that these are not God's people. And he reminded him that they were threatening God's people in God's land. He knew what should be done, so he prays about it in verses 8 to 10. It doesn't tell us that it's a prayer, but clearly Jonathan is now revealing to the armor bearer what he has prayed about. Can I get a volunteer to read 1 Samuel 14, verses 8 to 10? Yes. So here Jonathan is revealing to the armor bearer that he's put this to prayer and he's going to ask for a sign from God, and that sign will reveal what he ought to do, to stay or to go. And notice that the sign was not, if the easier thing happens, then I know you've given them into your hands. He didn't say, well, if we're going to scale down this cliff wall and we're going to get down to the valley in the bottom, hopefully we don't fall on the way, and when we get there, we're going to shout up to the Philistines, and if the Philistines tell us to scale the cliff and to come up to them, then we know God's given them into our hands. But if they say, no, stay there, then we know that God has not given them into their hands. Another lesson we learned from the life of Jonathan. This was a very important decision. This was life and death. Not every decision we make is life and death. But some decisions that we make, who we should pursue as a partner, what career we should chase after, who we should fill our lives with, what people will be the source of influence in our lives, those decisions ultimately do divide between life and death. And every one of those decisions, the friendships we make, the places we choose to live, the careers we pursue, where we go, and who we hang out with should be committed to prayer in our lives. And if we put God first in our life and seek His will and not our own, we can put our trust and our confidence that He will work mightily in our lives. Well, when they showed up to the garrison of the Philistines, it says in verse 11, they discover themselves, they yell up, hey! And the Philistines say, oh, look, there's the Hebrews. They're coming out of the holes where they've hid themselves. And the men of the garrison, the Philistines, say to Jonathan in verse 12, "Come up here and we'll show you a thing or two." There was what Jonathan was waiting for. The Philistines are thinking, these guys are absolute morons. There's two of them. They're going to be exhausted by the time they scale this cliff wall, if they can even make it up the cliff wall. And then we'll teach them a lesson for coming out of their hiding places. And Jonathan says halfway through verse 12 to his armor bearer, "Come up after me, for Yahweh hath delivered them into the hand of me," of Israel. There's no focus on Jonathan here still. He's just lost the throne, remember, because of his father's idiocy, because of his father's incompetence, because of his father's faithlessness. He's just been told that he will never come to the throne. He's not doing this because he's going to demonstrate that he was fit for the throne. Yahweh, the Lord, has given them into the hand of Israel. Contrast that with verse 24, where it reads, "And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, 'Cursed be the man that eateth any food until the evening, that I may be avenged of mine enemies.'" Mine. What happens? Well, Jonathan, the armor bearer, scale down the cliff wall. They go across the valley where they could have been shot with arrows or had spears thrown on them. They climb the next cliff and they start fighting. And there's only 20 men, 20 soldiers on this rock. And Jonathan's up there. They're single file. They can't get to him in a bunch. And Jonathan sort of taps them on the shoulder and punches them in the gut. And the armor bearer's behind him. And he shoves them through with his sword. And they fall off the cliff. And they go to the next and the next and the next. But beyond that cliff, that little piece that shut it out, there's an innumerable host who are starting to notice that something's going on. Verse 15. "And there was trembling in the host in the field and among all the people in the garrison and the spoilers. They also trembled and the earth quaked. It was a great trembling." And verse 16, "The multitude melted away, beating down one upon another." You see what happens when you put your faith in God, recognizing that God is with us and not with them. Our problems, brothers and sisters and young people, will melt away. What do we learn from Jonathan here? We learn that we need to get involved in the work and to take the hardest part on for ourselves. He didn't tell the armor bearer, "Hey, you know what? Why don't you go ahead up the cliff and I'll be right behind you?" No, he led the way up the cliff. And when we stand up for the truth, even a little stand, God will respond to our faith and make a way for us to succeed. And the children of Israel, when they saw the Philistines fleeing, came out of their hiding places. They came back across the river where they had fled. They stopped sitting with Saul trembling. And those that had defected to the Philistines, that's the fourth category, now come back. And they rally together. Well, what are the principles that we learn of leadership from Jonathan? First and foremost, worry about what we're doing and not who we are. The second thing, put God first in your life and trust in Him to lead you. Thirdly, put others before yourself. Fourth, get involved in the work. And fifth, take on the harder jobs for yourself. And if you do those things, you will inspire other people unto spiritual greatness. Thank you for your time and attention. Sorry for going a little over. We'll pick up tomorrow.